That was riveting. Good afternoon.
Good.
Hey, I want to show you before I get too into this. Come on, baby, don't do this to me. Come on. We're live. Wow, that was a riveting wow. There's a delay, though. I was watching Paul up here. I don't know, I can't want people to see this. Are you ready? There's a delay, isn't there? Anyway, I thought you'd get a kick. Who is that goofy looking? Oh, this is pitiful. Anyway, thank you again, Paul, for the special music. We are blessed people when it comes to music. I'm going to ask you, I was just thinking about this as Paul was doing his usual beautiful job. How many of you in this audience, careful now, how many of you in this audience have played the piano for services here? Raise your hand if you would, please. Quite a few of you. How many of you have played any instrument at all, ever, for services here in Eagle Rock? Please put your hands up. Quite a few. How many of you sing in the choir? More hands go up. All of you that have contributed to the music in this congregation, if you'd all raise your hands, please. Yeah, it's a lot of people. We're very blessed. Well, I don't know if I had to step out for a minute. Mr. Fish, I don't know if you said that Mr. Weber is in Vegas today. He's not in Vegas today? Yeah, he is in Vegas today. I think he's on slots, he said, by 3:30 he'd be on the... Mr. Budge is at Pechanga. He got lost on the way to Redlands. No, I'm kidding. We're going to give him a bad... No, they are serving God's people today, this Sabbath, elsewhere today. Now, if you came by car today, there were probably three of these particular items I'm going to reference for your car. Two of them are mandatory by law. They are essential for driving in Southern California especially. What are they? Well, they're often oblong, sometimes round. They're very, very shiny and very, very reflective. They're often covered. In some cases, they're motorized. And so what am I? I brought a prop. It's going to take me a minute to get it out. What are we talking about here? Does anybody know? Known as a rear view mirror. One of these. Now, please do not ask me. This was attached to an automobile that I own. Please do not ask me why it's not attached to the vehicle that I own and sitting here in front of you. Yes, indeed, it is your rear view mirror. And some of you, in fact, tell me, we have one. I have a lease car. It has a camera. So I have three rear view mirrors and a camera mounted on the dash. When I back up, I can see exactly where I am going. I understand that they'll be mandatory, these backup cameras. Can you all see each other? We'll just put it over there so people can see there. See? A smile? Very good. That ought to look great on video in Bakersfield. Oh, it was. Well, we did? Good. Hello, Bakersfield? Who else are we beaming to? Other people? Don't know? Anybody? And so all the people up here can see themselves. There we go. And so by 2016 or 2017, I understand these backup cameras will be mandatory in automobiles. They're that important, and they do save lives. Why are they so important other than the legal reasons? Well, they're used for two specific, very specific reasons. Number one is obviously to see what's coming up behind you. In backing up, obviously, it's what's behind you. In fact, some cars I know that when you back up and put the car in reverse, the rearview mirrors, how many of you have seen this? They tilt downward, right? I mean, is that cool or what? So they're very important to what we do. They also show you what's beside you. Now, my daughter, Vicky, we're going to pick on daughters today. I couldn't believe, I said, oh, wow. Lauren Ostley went after his daughter, and I'm going to bring up my daughter. And so neither one of us will be, our daughters will be speaking to us, Lauren, today. No, it's fine. Vicky has a fairly new car. And as I was driving it with her, we checked out the car on Consumer Reports and all that, but I didn't look at all the options on the car that she got, and she has a lot of options. Her dash does look like a NASA launch center, and indeed, I think she's got 12 airbags on the sides, the the doors, they're everywhere, in front of her, behind her. And she has at least three or four, I counted maybe five rearview mirrors. She's got them on the side. She's got them up front. She's got them everywhere. Then there was this beep as we were driving. And I said, honey, what's that? And something appeared on the dash. She says, oh, those are sensors on the sides of my rearview mirrors to detect if any vehicles while I'm driving gets closer than 5 or 6 feet. And I said, that's amazing. I said, what's this over here? And she says, that's the latte machine. Keep your hands off of it. You can have one later. But the reasons for the rearview mirrors are very obvious. I'm going to take this down because this thing is big. I should have cleaned it, eh? You don't care. But the reasons are obvious. They're for your safety and for the safety of other people around you. As many of you know, my dad was involved in racing in Los Angeles in the 1930s in automobile racing. Do you know how many rearview mirrors they had on race cars in LA in the 1930s? Zero. None. They may have had a mechanic with them driving, and that mechanic was supposed to look around to see who was around them when they passed, but as they got faster and faster, they wanted to lose weight, so they dumped the mechanic driver, and the driver drove the car, no rearview mirrors whatsoever. And that's why they stopped racing in Los Angeles, because it became so very deadly. As many of you know, NASCAR, stock car racing, as I call it, much inferior to Indianapolis racing. How many NASCAR fans did we have? Now, they have no outside rearview mirrors. They're only allowed inside on the roll bar. Formula One and Indianapolis-style cars, by contrast, the more mirrors you have on that car, the better. They are everywhere on those cars. And so, rearview mirrors are important. And I want to talk about a rearview mirror. They're very important. They're important in our cars. They're important when we drive, the people around us, the safety. I can remember when I was young, I was picked upon here in Southern California by local law enforcement. They were very mean. They were very, very unfair. They kept pulling me over, wanted to talk to me. After the innumerable time they pulled me over when I was young, I'm not bragging, I was embarrassed, they said, we're not pulling you over anymore. Get out of your car. They're taking this little card away from you, and you got to go to school. Now, some of you are smiling at me. You obviously know what that school is. But I remember one of the things long ago that the CHP officer who taught the course told us. He said, when I drive, he's basically a full-time professional driver. That's what Highway Patrol and law enforcement are. They do so much driving. He said, when I drive, he says, I look out my rearview mirror 50% of the time. 50%. He wants to know what's going on all around him, all the time. And many times, we will use our rearview mirror. Many times we don't, and we should have. One more race car story. One of the races I remember seeing a few years ago, there was a horrific crash on the track. And there was fire and smoke and tires and cars all over. It was horrible. And out of the big, huge plume of smoke and fire, out of that cloud, out came a car who made it successfully, one of the few that did. They interviewed the driver after the race. He said, all I saw in my rearview mirrors was smoke and fire and cars scattered all over the field. I can't believe I made it through it. And that's what he saw through his rearview mirror, and he kept on driving. But often when we drive, we are only seeing where we are, maybe to the left or the right of us, around us, what's ahead of us, but that's really only about 50 to 60% of the view. Often, I will see something, and many of you may do the same thing, where you'll be driving on a road somewhere, maybe in Southern California, maybe on the feast or at the feast, and you will see something and you will stop. My family knows this, and I'll say, look behind us, because what I've seen in the rearview mirror is just a small, small piece of this beautiful landscape that is behind us that we have just driven through. We stop, we get out, we look at the broad landscape where we have been. Maybe we just look up at the stars above us, the sky, and the clouds. So it's a completely different perspective behind us, utterly different, just like a sunset or a mountain range that we pass through. The things that we see, we never see behind us. With that as a backdrop, I'd like you to please turn to Psalm 77, where we will spend all of our time. This psalm will hopefully apply to us all in one way or another. You know, when we speak with one another, especially Mr. Fish and I are the only ones here today, especially those of us that are elders, or some of the deacons, and people will talk to us about the life that they are experiencing, the trials that they're going through, the pain and the suffering, the doubt, the fear, the anguish, the anxiety of what they are experiencing in their life. There are many in this congregation that have or are experiencing those things. We all do. I do. You do. Many are in doubt, and those severe, unexpected trials, none of them were asked for. They're surely never, ever wanted. And others of us at different times in our life are very reflective. The trials that we've been through, they've somehow now abated. They're behind us. We still think about them. We're still concerned about them. Will they come again? Will they happen all over again? And that is a part of the human condition. And it doesn't matter whether we're very, very young or very, very not so young. I was young once, and it didn't change. You still are worried about the things. I hate to break it to you, young people. Sorry. There are other things as you get older, you're still going to worry. They'll be different. They'll be brand new. But there are things you'll still be concerned about. And so whether we are young or whether not so young, these words can apply. Now, in Psalm 77, it is a very interesting psalm. And I wanted a section that would be applicable where we could read it through, because I believe, or my style is expository speaking. In other words, I stick in a book, we analyze it. Does it make sense? Is it consistent in thought? But I want you, as we read through this, to note the mood, the pronouns, and how they change, because they change not only in the English, they're changing in the Hebrew or the Greek translation. The psalm, try not to read too far ahead, the psalm begins very inwardly directed. It's very personal. And the commentaries state that there is a shift in both genre and syntax, as well as those of you that are musically or poetically inclined. The meter changes from 3 plus 3 to 3 plus 3 plus 3. So it is a greatly structured psalm, as you'll see. The most important aspect of this psalm, by far, is it is God's word. It is in His word. It is part of the canon. It is inspired, therefore, by His Spirit. And because, although it is 2,000 or more years old, it is still applicable to our day. It's applicable to my life, and I think and hope and pray it's applicable to your life. So maybe in this psalm we'll see a little bit of ourselves, and maybe we'll see some possible answers. So today, what I've entitled this is Looking Forward, Looking Back. Let's read verses 1 through 3. The Psalm of Asaph says, I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice. He gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Eternal. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained, and my spirit was overwhelmed. Selah. And that Selah is one of those breaks. It's in most of the ancient translations. Yours may or may not have it. So the psalmist says, I cried. My voice, he says twice for emphasis. My voice. I used my voice. So this is audible. That's how upset he has. I don't know how often you pray or when you pray, but most of us don't pray out loud. It disturbs the people around us, doesn't it, right? He's praying. How can you tell? I can hear him, right? But this prayer is audible. It says he gave ear to me, but in the day of my trouble, I sought the Eternal. It says I remembered God. I complained. My spirit, the ruach there, was overwhelmed. And the writer, indeed, we can tell in the first three verses, he is at his limit. What issue it is, we are not told. And the commentaries guess whether this is historical and has to do with Israel or it is personal. And at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter if we're not told. So therefore, it's applicable to us or for us. But he is worried. He is distraught. He is called on God. He says he gave me his ear, but God seemingly did not come. He stretched out his hands. He may be prostrate. in front of God, begging him. And that's what we call the Oriental fashion, when they will pray with arms outstretched on the ground, prostrate before God, pleading. And then it ends with Selah, which is the break. It's really an unknown meaning by most of the commentators. It is possibly, and I think we've had messages from time to time on this, it's possibly a musical or poetical mark, but in any event, it designates a break or a pause in the text. You need to stop. You need to think about what was said and why it was said. He then goes on in verse 4. He continues and says, "You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate with my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search." He's so distraught now. As he continues, he says, "I can't even talk. The mind is racing." He says he tries to recall his songs in the night, which are possibly hymns or remembrances that he gave to himself. Nothing seems to work. But can we not, at this point, and in these six short verses, if you're going through a trial, I surely don't want you to bring up and dwell on it in Sabbath service. This is about the last thing you want to do. But you know, and I know, when you're going through a trial, it sometimes doesn't leave you. You try and do something else. You try and think of something, some other subject. You try and get your mind off it. And it's very, very difficult to do. Extremely difficult to do. And so the psalmist, we can identify. We can relate. Because we too all have been concerned or distressed or upset or worried. There are health issues. There are financial issues. And both of them are sometimes related. We have financial issues because we have health issues. We have health issues because we have financial issues. The relationships that we have, our mothers, our fathers, our brothers, our sisters, our uncles, our nieces, our nephews, our children, our spouse, our friends, close relatives, distant relatives, they all engulf us. Many times they overwhelm us. And then there's church. You got church stuff that we think about and dwell on and harp on and complain about. These guys get up in front of us and speak, and they don't know what they're talking about. There's all kinds of issues. Things worry us. Worries create other worries. Anxiety creates other anxieties. And again, it doesn't matter if you're young. Oh, the young, they don't worry. You, not so young, remember when you were young. We worried. We were concerned. Ah, but now it's different. Problems are bigger. So I'm older. They're different. No, they're no different. They're no different what age you are or where you are or who you are. Everyone has anxiety. Everyone goes through trials. And at some point, you start to question. You start to question, and that is a normal human trait. In fact, we find it with the psalmist, as we'll see in the next few verses. Here he begins, because it's all about him. It's all about him. Recently, before we read this, the psalmist asked these questions. Recently, someone commented on a message I gave long ago on Romans 7, O wretched man. And to recall what the chapter is about in Romans 7, Paul basically says, the things I wish I could do, I don't do. And the things I know I shouldn't do, I do. Oh, wretched man that I am. And the bottom line is that Paul, the Apostle Paul, he was no saint. He was not perfect. He had problems just like we do. And this person said, it's good to know even Paul struggled with life. It's good to know because we have something in common. But we also have something in common with the six questions in these next verses. Verse 7. He asks in almost staccato fashion, will the Eternal cast off forever? Will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Six very pointed questions. Now, I don't know if you've ever asked these questions. I have. You get to a point where you say, what is happening? Why is this happening? Why is not God involved? Why is not God doing something? As we heard in the first message, absolutely, we are impatient. So was the psalmist. Can you imagine his world? He didn't have any smartphones or television or internet, and he was impatient. How much more so are we? Notice that four of these questions are time-oriented. They have to do with time. Again, it relates to patience. Forever, will God ever, ever help me? Will he ever pull me out of this? Will this ever end? We'll just keep going on and on and on. And so we have these same questions. But notice the last one, because they're put in a very interesting order. The last one says, is he angry with me? Is God angry with me? Have I done something wrong? One of the saddest situations we had in the ancient world, and it even carries over today, is that sickness and trouble was a direct result of one thing and one thing only. Well, the reason you're sick. You know why you're sick. You know why these things are happening to you, Job. You're a bad person. You know why these things happen? You know why you're sick? You know why all these bad things happen to you? Because you're a bad person. God's angry with you. That's why you're being punished. Let's go get a hamburger. I know you've never had people talk to you like that. I know you've never heard that, and may it never be that those words ever came across your mouth. Because that is a very, very simple, very simplistic comment. Indeed, we can be sick. We can bring on health issues because of the stupid things we do, bad choices, and bad habits. That's understandable. But it surely doesn't explain all of it. If indeed sickness was a result of sin, we'd all have terminal cancer, wouldn't we? We'd all be very, very ill if it was directly related to evil intent. But it doesn't explain it all. But we also know that we are all under the death penalty, aren't we? Everyone in this room. Every man, woman, and child are under the death penalty in this room. But because we are under God's mercy through his Son, Jesus Christ, and have accepted his sacrifice, we have eternal life and we are no longer under the death penalty. The psalmist develops, though, and he comes to a point here, but he also is obsessed in these first few verses with who? Himself. It's me, my hand, my soul, my spirit, my pleading, my impatience. It's me. C.S. Lewis writes, "Now the self can be regarded in two ways. On the one hand, it is God's creature, an occasion of love and rejoicing. Now indeed, hateful in condition, but to be pitied and healed. But on the other hand, it is that one self of all others, which is called I and me, and which on that ground puts forward an irrational claim to preference." You should do this, in other words, because it's me. That's why. An irrational claim to preference. This claim is to be not only hated, but simply killed. Never, as George MacDonald says, ever be allowed a moment's respite from eternal death. We are all human beings. We all, at the end of the day, love me. We love ourselves. Rearview mirrors are also mirrors that people use to look at themselves. We have mirrors in our house. We have lots of mirrors in our house. The human condition is, indeed, that it is obsessed with self. And it's important to understand that at this verse, this section of the chapter, in verse 10, there is a change in perspective. There is a pivot, as it were. And we again see the word Selah, to pause. No longer in verse 10, and let's read it, do we hear so much about me. Because watch the change. "And I said, this is my anguish, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High." And now we will see a complete and utter shift in the psalmist's words. Verse 10, I looked up about 15, 16 different translations. It is, apparently it is difficult in translating. The NIV and New King James have essentially the same thought. I will remember. This is what I must do. I must remember the right hand of God. The right hand of God is the right hand of the Most High, Elyon. The right hand is significant. The right hand is significant for a number of reasons. It was the high hand that God rescued Israel. If you'll remember, it is with a high hand. I'm left-handed, so the left hand goes up. Sorry. It is with a high hand that God rescued Israel. Behold the hand of God, if you'll remember, during the Exodus. And who is God's right hand? Who sits at God's right hand? Is it not Jesus Christ? Who is God's, as we would say in the vernacular in this century, who is God's right hand? It is Jesus Christ. Now let's read verses 10 through 14 in context. And I said, this is my anguish, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great as our God? You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. Look at the change. A complete reordering of priorities. A complete reordering of emphasis and perspective. Now, who does he look to? He's looking to God. But look at how it's stated. Think of a rearview mirror. I will remember the works of the Lord. I will surely remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. It's all in the past tense. It's all about what God has done. It's all the good things that God has done in the psalmist's life. He's looking, as it were, in the rearview mirror of where he's been, what has happened throughout his entire life. Excuse me. Through his entire life. The word remember means to memory, to bring up into memory, to look back on where the road had taken him and all the things that he had seen, all the things that he had experienced. He was reminding himself, like going through a photo album in reverse, all the past events. He says he will meditate. He says, your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Very interesting word. We'll get to that in a minute. There's also interesting in these verses alone, a note on names. That those that hold that God only hears his name and he has a specific name, they'll have trouble with these verses. Verse 10 is Elyon. Verse 11 is Yah. Verse 13 is Elohim, twice El once. Verse 14 is Ha'el. These are all the names of God. These are all the names of the Creator. But the focus is on God. The focus has been shifted away from himself. The focus is now on God and what God has done. Verse 13 says the word sanctuary, which is where we get the word chodesh or chodesh, which means something holy. It could reference to the temple or the sanctuary itself, or even it could refer to the holy of holies by extension. It is basically the sanctuary. Now remember, the sanctuary to anyone in our day is where God is. In 70 AD, there is no temple. So it's where God is. He says, read it again, your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. It's where God lives. Hebrews 4:16 and Ephesians 4:12, you can note those if you wish. Ephesians 4:12, Hebrews 4:16 tell us that we have access to the very throne, the Holy of Holies in heaven. And we have this through the access of Jesus Christ. And so we can talk to God directly. We can go directly to his throne because of this belief in Christ. So if indeed we have access to God and his throne through Jesus Christ, then we too have these wonders. We too have these works available to us. We too have this protection that the psalmist talks about. But indeed is a change of perspective that he writes. It is the view from behind. It is the view of what has happened. And why is that important? Where one has been, what one has experienced must be remembered. The experiences that you have, God gave you so you would remember them. And there is a reason. In Deuteronomy 8:10 is the reason why many people pray after a meal. It says, when you are full, when God has given you all these good things, then say thanks. And every once in a while, we'll pray after a meal. You remember after the meal. When you pray before a meal, which is perfectly acceptable, very, very understandable, it's before you've gotten what you're going to get. But after you've received it, isn't it a wonderful thing to say, wasn't that a great meal? We thank the people who cooked it. We should always say, thank the people who did the work. We're grateful. We understand if it was a wonderful meal after we've experienced it. The prayer you could pray before the meal, I sure hope this food is good and they knew what they were doing when they cooked it. We thank them for their hands and, you know, we always make the joke, God, please bless this, whatever this is in front of me, right? But after you've eaten it, aren't you more grateful? After you've experienced it, doesn't your perspective change? One's expectation, one's gratification or gratitude. The idea is we look back to see how often God has ordered our life. We look back as to how many times, they are times without counting, times innumerable where God has stepped in, sometimes unseen. How many times in your life, in my life, has something occurred and we were very concerned about and it was gone? We forgot it was gone, forgot it was there, and then maybe days, maybe weeks, it may be even years later, you figure it out. What happened? How it happened? How it could have happened? Well, I guess that was a miracle. That was a miracle. And we look back on it and have to remember. God doesn't ask us, or doesn't say to us, you forgot, didn't you? He doesn't have the ego we have. But it's important that we do remember, that we look for those experiences that where God is involved in our life. We remind ourselves. We should remind ourselves. And so we conclude in verses 15 through 20. Now, these verses have tremendous structure. I'm going to give you the words. It's called an inversion. This inversion uses it's a poetic term. It's the use of words at the beginning and the same type of words at the end and the similar words toward the middle and then words in the middle. And it moves out and it moves in and then it moves back to where it started with the same concepts. It's very common in the Bible. So look for these. And as we read them, look at this poetic use of words. There's also historical recounting in these words that we're going to read. And the psalmist ends this psalm, very importantly, with a very epic moment that had happened some 600 years earlier to the psalm writing. To Psalm 77 is some 500 to 600 years prior. And yet the writer remembers. In fact, the writer has been talking about it in code, as it were, all along. But now he becomes very, very plain in what he's going to say. It has to do with the Exodus. So what he says is something very important. He starts with people. He moves to water. He moves from water to the heavens, from the heavens back to water, and then from water back to people. Look at this structure. Also, as you read it, I'm going to ask you to think of your life. Think of the people in your life. Think of the water in your life and where something came from heaven to help you. Remember those three important events in all the years that you have lived, whether they be short or whether they be long. Where God stepped in, where God left no footprints, no fingerprints. There's nothing to say he was there. But in hindsight, he was there. So let's read verse 15. He says, you have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, O God. The waters saw you, they were afraid. The depths also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The sky sent out a sound. Your arrows also flashed about. The voice of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Can you see that structure, the beautiful poetic symmetry there? This was not just thrown together. This is thrown together with great intent by the author. What does it say to us? It says to us that God has always acted in our lives. The psalmist recognizes that. Therefore, we should too. We should realize that God has always acted in our life. He's always there. In fact, Jesus says in the New Testament that he would never leave us or forsake us, ever. It's important that we understand that it is timely for us, that for many of us it is timely because of what we have or are going through. It may be important for what many of us will go through in the year, months and years ahead. God always provides a way, seen and unseen. He never forgets. He never misses a cue. He's never late. He never sleeps. He never stops watching. He may not act as we would. He may not answer prayers the way we want him to. But it's important to remember that he does, and he always will provide a way out that he has determined. He's the Father, we're the children. He's the ultimate Father, and we are not so often the obedient children. So it is in the reflective looking back that we sometimes truly see what God wants us to see. It's only from that perspective that we often are able to stop, turn around, and remember what we see. And so, when you go home tonight, or better yet, when you need a better view of the life that you've lived and who's been involved in it, use your rearview mirror.